This is Joakim Noah of the Chicago Bulls, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin. And let's see how the ball's gonna bounce today.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. In this episode, we have a special episode with Grant Goodstein. Grant Goodstein is the head student manager at the University of Michigan for the men's basketball team. He's also an analytics coordinator. Grant came on the Bullseye to discuss many topics, but really brought his expertise when it comes to analytics, and we really enjoyed having him on. We talked on a variety of topics, including Grant went a little bit over his background and his role with the University of Michigan basketball team. Grant explained what analytics is to the average fan, discussed common analytical terms like plus minus PER, and especially what the terms, the analytics that he really likes to look at when determining the effectiveness of a basketball player. Discussed the Sloan Conference, what goes on there, what analytics jumped out when he was looking at the Bulls players from this completed season. And also, most importantly, what I thought was very interesting were some of the top NBA prospects in the Big Ten and in basketball, NCAA basketball this year in general. Grant has worked with a ton of players who are now in the NBA, like Tim Hardaway Jr., Trey Burke, Nick Stauskas, Mitch McGarry, Glenn Robinson. So he's seen a lot of them, and he knows what an NBA player looks like. So really enjoyable to hear his take on some of the better prospects that are coming out this season. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I'm going to post Grant's information on the Chicago Bullseye website. Go to www.chicagobullseye.com to find him. You can also follow him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Grant Goodstein. That's at Grant, G-O-O-D-S-T-E-I-N. At Grant Goodstein, so feel free to reach out to him. Until next time, all the best. I hope you enjoy the show.
First of all, thank you so much for joining us. To start out, first question, why don't you go a little bit over your background and your role with the University of Michigan basketball team?
So I'm a graduating senior at Michigan. I studied economics, my degree's in economics. And for the past 4 years, I've been lucky enough to spend some time with Michigan men's basketball working as a student manager. I understand that probably many of you don't know exactly what a student manager does, but we like to say that managers allow the players to play and the coaches to coach, and we take care of the rest. So we're setting up practice, we're cleaning it up, we're passing, we're rebounding, we're running the game clock and shot clock, keeping score, refereeing, anything that needs to get done around the program, we're there to help our coaching staff and our players. And additionally, for the past two seasons, I've worked on with Coach Beilein and our assistant coaches, serving as the analytics coordinator for Michigan, and I'm actually the first person to focus on analytics really heavily within the Big Ten. So that's been a really interesting opportunity for me to learn a lot about more about analytics, and especially in the NBA is very data rich, and college basketball not so much. So it's been a great learning experience for me.
Grant, hi, this is Tim. And as far as analytics goes, maybe talk a little bit for the common fan. What does analytics mean? I know it means numbers and analysis of those numbers, but maybe talk a little bit about, at least from your view, what that really means, and then maybe some common terms like plus, minus, and PER, and what are some of those categories that you think are really the most relevant when measuring a team or a particular player?
Yeah, so analytics really, when you get down to it, it's just one tool of many tools that we have in our arsenal to look at the game of basketball, and doing so through numbers. There's so many ways you could do it. There's so much data out there, whether it's spatial data, whether it's counting stats as far as the box score, whether it's more qualitative stats, that there's a lot of services like Synergy out there that help catalog those. There's so many ways. But for the casual NBA fan or even a more hardcore NBA fan, I think the best way to really understand player and team performance better than maybe you do today is to look at rate stats, which are per 48-minute stats, per possession stats, or percentage stats, rather than counting stats like points per game, assists per game, free throws per game. because when you're looking at those rate stats, those adjust for all different factors that teams might have different. Like a team like the Warriors is going to get up and down the court so much faster than a team like the Bulls is going to. So while you can look at the points per game, that doesn't tell you the full story. So I think it's really important for fans to start maybe paying a little more attention to those rate-based stats. And as far as from a college or NBA team's perspective, really crucial point that I think isn't considered enough within the NBA and within college basketball too, is that analytics are as relevant as the GMs, the coaches, and the players' abilities to understand and implement them are. Because every player, GM, coach, they have a different interest and a different aptitude for analytics. And that depends. Maybe it's a generational thing. It could be the way the player thinks, the way the coach thinks. But a guy like Shane Battier has spoken a lot about his appetite for statistics, about how he likes to know every tendency, how he likes to know everything there is. Whereas there's other guys who really are just more instinctual, and that's how they prefer to play. So a huge, huge crucial point for analytics is knowing your audience and making sure you target that data at that audience.
Got it. And wasn't Shane Battier, probably his time with the Rockets, and Daryl Morey obviously one of the leading minds in terms of analytics, but at least for me as a fan and a lifelong NBA and basketball fan, to me the whole analytics concept really jumped to the forefront with the Rockets and Daryl Morey and when Shane Battier was playing. And the thing that really the light bulb came on for me is how Shane Battier maybe didn't have the most points or most rebounds in a game, but his plus minus or his impact on the game when he was on the floor was so significant. So for me, that was kind of a tipping point, I guess you could say. Is that somewhat valid?
Yeah, absolutely. Daryl Morey's story is unique when it comes to NBA GMs. Prior to him, the GMs were mostly former successful NBA players or scouts. And Morey actually is a Northwestern grad who went on to get his MBA at MIT, at the Sloan School there. So he really had a way different background. And Rockets owner Leslie Alexander was really, I think, pretty innovative in bringing in that kind of mind to run the team. And we can argue about exactly how well the plan has worked there in Houston, and maybe there's rumors that changes will be made this summer. But overall, I think they've done a nice job of contending. Ever since Morey's been there, they've been relevant every year. And for anyone that hasn't had a chance to read it, there's a fantastic article written, I think it's for the New York Times, by Michael Lewis, who's the author of Moneyball. He did a great piece on Shane Battier and the Rockets, and that's a must-read for anyone with any sort of interest in analytics in the NBA.
Grant, could you go over some of the common analytical terms, you know, like the plus-minus, the PER, the ones that we're kind of familiar with? What categories do you think are the most relevant in some of the newer numbers that you find especially effective when measuring a team?
So plus-minus is kind of, I think it's probably most popular in hockey, where you have this, the line changes, where you have guys shifting in math on and off the ice. But it's actually become more and more popular in basketball as a way to measure certain players' effectiveness or lineup or combinations of players' effectiveness. But the problem with plus-minus in my mind is that it's not really adjusted to level of competition. Recently, ESPN's come out with their real plus-minus, which attempts to figure that in, and I'll trust them that they're doing a decent job, and that's a great stat to check out. But I'm not really the kind of math mind that can decode exactly the math that went into that formula. But I think there's definitely some things to be gleaned from plus-minus, but definitely something to be taken with in proper context. With PER, PER is another really nice stat that primarily focuses on offensive performance and a player's efficiency, with 15 as the league average. So you can see that a guy around 20 is a really good player. Above 25 is a really elite level player, and anywhere below 15 is below league average from an efficiency standpoint. So that's a really interesting way to look at the game. And as we talk more and more about these teams especially with Golden State and San Antonio. They're just brutally efficient and make the most out of every possession and maximize that expected point value through three-point shooting and through limiting turnovers and all those sorts of things. Those are some really nice stats to be able to gauge those. And then you also have some other stats that I really like to look at are percentage-based stats. So rather than talking about, this player is rebounding the ball, offensive rebounding the ball three times a game, it's really more interesting to look at it. When he's on the court, what percentage of available misses from his own team is he grabbing? So there's all different ways to look at basketball through this different lens that I think are really useful.
Got it. Well, that's helpful. And we've talked a little bit about Daryl Morey and the Sloan Conference. And, again, while we're talking about some of these analytics terms and uses, I know you've been to the Sloan Conference multiple times. Maybe talk a little bit about that because it's gotten publicity, obviously, through ESPN and some other news sources, both from a sports standpoint and a business standpoint, but maybe talk a little bit about what goes on at the Sloan Conference and what things you've submitted there, what things you've learned there.
Yeah, so the Sloan Conference, you may have heard of it referred to as Dorkapalooza by Bill Simmons, which is probably a very accurate title for the event, but it's an annual event that's held in Boston at the convention center there, and it's focused on sports analytics. And it started out actually in an MIT classroom in its first year with Bill James and Daryl Morey and some other kind of analytics luminaries. And since then, it's just taken off like you can't believe. I think this year they had something like 4,000 attendees. And it's really the go-to event in the industry for networking. There are representatives from all 30 NBA teams there, as well as the majority of teams in the NHL, MLB, and NFL. And really, the first year I was there was, I think that was 2011, and that was maybe around 1,000 people that year, and it was a little more manageable. But truth be told, now 4,000 people, you won't hear too much groundbreaking analytics information at the conference because no team is wanting to give up its secrets to 4,000 people and all the GMs and scouts and analytics people who are there. So it's a little bit more of just a way to hear guys like Jeff Van Gundy and Shane Battier and GMs, hear them talk, and it's a great, great place to network as well if you're looking to break into the industry. And the research paper competition is a really fun part of the conference as well. A few years back, I co-authored a paper about the NBA draft that was a semifinalist paper. And the gist of that was that the number one predictor of NBA draft position is a player's college counting stats. So that's like points per game, assists per game, rebounds per game. We found a very highly positive correlation. As those numbers go up, their expected draft position becomes higher and higher. They're technically lower towards the first pick.
Expected draft position is correlated to how high their rebounds per game, points per game, et cetera. Do you have any correlation on NBA success with college numbers?
So the real fact is that with those counting stats, this was our big finding, that they're not at all predictive. There's zero statistically significant correlation between those counting stats and their NBA performance. And we gauged those using a stat called win shares that you can find on Basketball Reference. On the other hand, we took a look at the rate stats that I was telling you about earlier, and one that we looked at in particular was through a great service called KenPom.com, which is just the ultimate resource for college basketball statistics. Highly recommend anyone interested in analytics check that out. But they have an offensive rating stat, which is a measure of efficiency, in many ways probably pretty similar to PER. And that stat had an extremely positive correlation with win shares. But on the other hand, it was not at all predictive of when a player was going to be drafted. So essentially our finding there was that the NBA draft market is not very efficient in that regard, and that GM, scouts, whoever it is, aren't considering enough these advanced rate stats when they're evaluating players.
That's interesting.
Yep. So, Grant, in terms of some of these things that you've studied and kind of put into play, what things could you maybe give us a couple of examples of things that you put into action to the Michigan team? And I know in our discussions you talked about the adoption of some of this is somewhat generational, and you know, it just really, you know, varies probably program to program, you know, coach to coach. But maybe talk about how you got the attention of the Michigan basketball coaching staff with some things, and then what are some examples of things you put into action?
Yeah, so I had really two main focuses at Michigan. One was gauging our team and player performance to both help us evaluate what we could improve on and maybe which actions or which players were proving most successful in game scenarios. And then there were also, I really wanted to delve into in-game scenarios as well. And it's really important for our staff to have as many tools to evaluate the play of different players and lineups as they can. Plus minus was a big way we did that. I was responsible for charting lineup and player plus minus each game. And we also used a service called Hoop Lens that can really break things down based on specific combinations. That's a fantastic service that's invaluable for us. As far as the in-game scenarios, I did a lot of thinking about that. There was quite a bit of talk amongst our staff on the right time to start fouling when you're trailing late in the second half in a college game. So that was really something that I did quite a bit of time, spent quite a bit of time studying. And I also was able to create a model that estimates a player's probability of fouling out based on a player's historical fouling tendencies and the time remaining in the game. And I think that was able to help guide our staff on the risk-reward of keeping a player with foul trouble in the game or taking him out. Another, this is maybe my favorite thing that I've had the chance to look at, is the one-on-one foul in college basketball. So I know many of the people listening to this are first and foremost Chicago Bulls fans, but for anyone that watches a lot of college basketball, they'll know that teams with the 7th, 8th, and 9th foul in each half, the free throw shooter goes to the line to shoot a 1-1 foul on our 1-1 free throws on non-shooting fouls. So if the player misses the first free throw, that ball is live. So that really changes how the expected point value of each possession. So I've done a lot of thinking about using those 1-1 fouls in each half strategically, a la a hack a Shaq or hack a Dwight or hack a Drummond, whoever, which you see all the time in the NBA, but I've actually never seen it in college hoops. And interestingly enough, the intentional foul was eliminated from the NCAA rulebook a couple years ago. So while I haven't seen it in practice, I'm fairly certain that there wouldn't be a penalty for fouling a player without the ball. And each team gets 3 of those fouls per half, and I think that they could be really valuable, especially for teams that might have trouble getting defensive stops, which Michigan over the past couple of years has been one of those teams. And unfortunately, that idea was a little too far out there for our staff, so never got to see that one tried out. But I hope that someone, I hope some other maybe young coach who's trying to give his team a little bit of an edge will put that into action and see how that goes.
Right. Well, on past tough podcasts, Fred and I have talked a lot about the hack of Jordan, you know, hack of Dwight and so on. And we really haven't decided to delve into all the analytics of it. But I know just from an intuition standpoint, it seems like the team fouling, you know, even though the player might be missing those free throws, it slows down the pace of the game or the momentum of the game. And you know, maybe you've got some numbers that would back those things up, but I know just from a viewing the game standpoint, though, these last few playoff games with so many poor free throw shooters, even Houston with Josh Smith missing free throws and Dwight Howard, it's just painful to watch as a fan. But I understand from a strategy standpoint why you might want to implement it.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I really also can't stand it as a fan, and I hope that both college and NBA basketball will move to change that rule, because that's just not really fun for anyone to watch and bad for the quality of the game. But as someone that's trying to help a team win, I don't care what the quality of the game looks like to the fans. I want to get my team to outscore the other team. So I definitely think from a strategic point of view, it's very intriguing, especially at the college level with the 1-1 fouls. But I definitely think from a fan's perspective, not so enjoyable to watch.
Quick question, Grant, and this is a little bit off what we had discussed, but I'm curious to know if you saw a team in the Big Ten this year that had really, really, you know, top of the line analytical numbers that didn't necessarily translate into success on the court.
You know, for the most part, the numbers add up pretty well. Obviously, Michigan State had just a fantastic regular season, and analytically, from any perspective, they were so strong this season. But unfortunately for them, and maybe fortunately for all my fellow Michigan fans, they were bounced in the first round. Similarly, Purdue was one of the strongest teams defensively all year, bounced in the first round. So those are the teams that jump to mind the most. But for the most part, I think the teams that people thought were going to be good this year did pretty well in the Big Ten, and the numbers definitely backed that up. We had some really outstanding teams between Indiana, Michigan State, Purdue, Iowa, Maryland, Wisconsin. I mean, those six were all really high-quality college teams. And
I was saying it selfishly, as an Illinois grad, I couldn't figure out why we fared so poorly this season, and was hoping the analytics painted a rosier picture than actually what we saw on the court.
I hate to tell you, but the analytics didn't make that season look any better. KenPom had Illinois the 132nd best team in the country, so I actually was fairly surprised to see that John Gross is going to get another year, but he hasn't had the best luck as far as his team's injuries, so I guess he's getting the benefit of the doubt here, but I think if there's not a better season for the Illini next year, that they'll be looking for another head coach very shortly.
Yeah, Grant, well, while we're talking about the Big Ten and the teams, you've obviously been at Michigan for a great stretch of time. I know your freshman year you guys got to the championship game and that close loss to Louisville. So, and you've been on the court and worked out a number of your colleagues there, Tim Hardaway Jr., Trey Burke, Stauskas, Mitch McGarry, Glenn Robinson III. So you know what an NBA player looks like. You've been on the floor with enough of them. Who did you see in the Big Ten this year that really jumped out at you? And even in Michigan's non-conference schedule, were there a few players that jumped to mind as we're kind of looking ahead in the next few months to the NBA draft of people that you really liked?
Yeah, two of the guys who were really impressive to me were some big men, with Diamond Stone from Maryland, Deontay Davis from Michigan State. Diamond Stone has just a really, really rare touch for a guy his size. He's about 6'9", 6'10", and probably a good 260, 70 pounds. Big load, but he is a fantastic around the basket and a rare guy that you see at the college level or even the pro level at that position that is an excellent free throw shooter. I want to say his free throw percentage was around 80% this year. And as we've seen, and we were talking about previously with the hack-a-shack style tactics that are being used, it's just so crucial to have a big guy, I think, that in crunch time that you can keep on the floor. I think that really came back to bite Detroit. You saw them come so close in three of the four games this series against Cleveland, but they really can't keep one of their best players, Andre Drummond, on the floor for the last parts of the game because he just can't make those free throws. So I think that's a big asset for Diamond Stone. He's a little undersized maybe, but he actually has a 7'3 wingspan. So I think he's a really ideal small ball five at the next level. And as we see teams playing smaller and smaller, I think that's the ideal five man, is a 6'9" guy with long arms who can be a five in the NBA. So he's not super quick, and he's not a very good rebounder at this point, but I think he's going to slim down. He's going to get in really great shape. A lot of times people forget that college basketball players are also living that college lifestyle, and it wouldn't shock me that Diamond Stone was going out having several beers on the weekend or maybe eating a lot of fast food pizza or whatever it is. So I think what he gets on that NBA lifestyle, and that's not anything targeted just at Diamond Stone, but just at any college player, when they focus on that full time, they're going to get in that much better shape. And I think he's going to be a really good pick. It's probably the late lottery And then Deontay Davis is another big man with good touch. I think that's super important now that it's great to have a big man that can step out and hit. They don't need to be a three-point shooter, but a guy who can shoot from 15, 16 feet is really an immense advantage. And he's also a fantastic defensive player, someone who's going to be a shot blocker, can play either the four or the five, super flexible in that way. It's a little probably thin right now, but he'll benefit from a year or two in the weight room with the with an NBA staff, and I think he's going to be a really good pro as well. Some other guys around the Big Ten real quick. Denzel Valentine, I think, is very solid. His improvement from his freshman year to senior year was incredible to see in person, and he's just so confident. He's a knockdown shooter, sees the court so well for an off guard. Like him a lot as another mid-first-round guy. Mm-hmm. Strathen, loving the little guard. Yogi Ferrell from Indiana was really great at the college level, and I think that's going to translate to the NBA. He's one of those guys who, in person, it's unbelievable to see how quick he is. And he was really what enabled Indiana to play its fast-paced offense at such a high level. He can shoot the ball really well. He can pass the ball really well. As with other little guys, there's concerns with him at the defensive end. But I think he's the perfect backup point guard right away for a team, especially a team that wants to play fast. And I think he can grow into a bigger role as his career moves on. As far as guys I'm not as high on, I'm going to start out with two of the guys from Maryland, and Melo Trimble and Robert Carter. As far as Trimble goes, he's just so inconsistent, and that's concerning to me. He doesn't really bring it on a nightly basis. And that's something that basic lack of competitiveness and ability to show up from night to night is to me, as an evaluator of players, is the single most concerning thing that you could have from a player. And then Robert Carter, who's really intriguing because of his athleticism at his size, is a 6'8" guy who's big and built and can dribble the ball fairly well. But he's just not quite skilled enough, and I think that his inability to shoot is not going to is going to make him unlikely to succeed in the NBA. And last guy in Maryland would be Jake Layman, who I actually do like as a second-round sleeper. He's a little bit Chandler Parsons-esque in that he can shoot the ball, he can put it on the deck, and I think he's a solid guy that is worth taking a shot on in the second round. And my favorite guy, who's a local player, not in the Big Ten, but my favorite player to watch this year in college basketball, many of you may not have heard his name, but it's Kay Felder from Oakland University. And he just had an unbelievable year in the Summit League and against high major competition in games versus Michigan State and Virginia. He basically single-handedly took Michigan State to overtime in a game at the Palace of Auburn Hills. So that was pretty cool to watch. He's tiny. He's about 5'8", but he's real well-built and real athletic and has unbelievable vision. He led the country in assist rate, and he's criticized a little bit for his shooting, but he finished the year at 36% from three, which isn't too bad. And just from a visual basis, his shot looks pretty solid. And his jump shot, I think, still can improve. And he's an absolute gamer. He always showed up for their big games this season. And I think he's going to be a steal in the second round. He gets a lot of comparisons to Isaiah Thomas from the Celtics. And I think that's a really, really great comparison for him. And I think he's going to be an electric guy in the NBA as well.
Yes, I've seen Felder a few times, and yeah, he's left-handed and it is undersized, but yeah, he plays with unbelievable heart, and saw him have some big games against really good teams. So that's an interesting guy to keep an eye on. We'll keep an eye out for Felder
last guy I want to talk about is Caris LeVert, who's another Michigan guy and who will be in pretty crazy in my 4 years to have been able to work with. He'll be the sixth NBA player, which is not exactly been so common in years prior at Michigan. So he's had a really nice run here of a lot of talented players. And firstly, to his character, he's one of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life, and there's not one person who will say, can or will say anything negative about him. And that's a concern with some guys, but it will never be a concern for Caris, as he's a great guy. On the court, he's a really good shooter from three, but he's got to get a lot better at his shooting off the dribble. He struggled throughout his whole college career shooting off the dribble, so he has a long way to go there. But he's a great ball handler, great shooter, and I think that if he can – he recently underwent foot surgery and his second foot surgery at Michigan. And if he does – if he can come back healthy from this, I think that he has a chance that his ceiling would be kind of a Jamal Crawford-like career. It's a guy who can really get his team buckets through his ball handling and shooting.
Right, I know. It's great. It was tough seeing him have to miss so much time due to injuries. Really, the last 2 years, he's really hardly played. So I would think there's probably some shrewd scout out there, though, that's seen what he's done early in his career. And, and they'll put their money on him working through the injuries and getting back to strength. And, yeah, I always liked Caris LeVert. He seemed like one of those long, versatile, kind of a hybrid player. Right, could play a couple positions. And I'll look forward to see what he does at the next level. So.
Absolutely. Right, and I think it can be overblown that some of these guys, I saw it personally with Mitch McGarry, that he went out and he had an injury his whole second half of his sophomore year. And these Chad Ford and these draft prognosticators can overreact to that stuff. Whereas you saw with Mitch McGarry, the Thunder had seen enough. They saw his potential, and they were willing to still take a chance on him at, I want to say, the 25th pick in the draft. So I think for all the talk about Caris sliding in the draft, I wouldn't be shocked at all to see him still drafted in the late first round or early second, whereas people have been prognosticating that he might slide towards the bottom half of the second round.
That's a great overview of some of the prospects I know a lot of the listeners are going to be looking for. So thanks a lot for that, Grant. I had a quick question, though, for you regarding the NBA and the Bulls specifically. Have you had a chance to follow the Bulls at all? And if so, any analytics jump out when you're looking at that team and the bizarre, disappointing season that it was this year?
Yeah, for me, my focus that is devouring me during the college basketball season is with the Big Ten. So I don't have a whole lot of chance to watch much NBA during the regular season, but I did go ahead and do a bit of research in preparing to talk about the Bulls on this season. So just looking at the basic offensive and defensive efficiency numbers, it's pretty clear that the Bulls really struggled scoring the ball this year. With 101 points per 100 possessions, which is 25th in the league. And they were also 25th in the league in effective field goal percentage. And effective field goal percentage is a field goal percentage that adjusts upwards for the value of a three-point shot. So they really struggled there, and it's hard to be a good team in today's NBA if you can't shoot. And another thing that's killing the Bulls is that Derrick Rose isn't the player he once was. As I said earlier in the podcast, PER, player efficiency rating, 15 is league average, and his PER this season was 13.5. So that's a tick below league average. And the Bulls were a minus 3.8 per 48 minutes when Derrick Rose were on the court versus when he wasn't. So they were a net negative with him on the court. And when you have a guy on a max contract like he is performing at that level, it's really, really difficult to win a lot of games. I also took a look at at some of the plus-minus data, and it was striking that the Bulls only had two rotation players with a positive plus-minus this season, and that was Tony Snell and Nikola Mirotic. And the best lineup by a good margin was the combination of Rose, Butler, McDermott, Mirotic, and Gasol, which was a solid lineup offensively at 105 points per 100 possessions, and excellent defensively at 98 points per 100 possessions, which is kind of interesting to take a look at and a little bit of why you definitely need film to back up some of these analytics, because McDermott and Mirotic both grayed out as two of the worst defenders on the Bulls team. So I'd be interested to go look in Synergy or a similar service and see what was the key was to those lineups playing so well defensively, which maybe you wouldn't expect. And when you look at their most used lineup, which is Rose, Butler, Snell, Mirotic, and Gasol, they were fantastic defensively at 95 points per 100 possessions, but they were just as bad on the offensive end at 96 points per 100 possessions. So I really think that a key for the Bulls is despite the change from Tibbs to Hoiberg, the defense stayed pretty solid this year, but they're going to have to find a way to put the ball in the basket and add some shooting, especially at the guard position.
Well, it's interesting to hear that, especially I did look at, I think those are the cumulative plus minus numbers, and you know, Tony Snell led the team, and by any measure, Tony Snell sucked this year. You know, from most to the average fans, he was an absolute disaster. And so I, when I look at that set, I kind of look at, you got to also kind of factor in total minutes, right? I mean, I think the guy who had the highest was Gasol. Gasol with a plus minus was just below, was one of the few starters who was, he was near the top. I think he was third or fourth. And I know a lot of fans can't stand Gasol for whatever reason. I'm one of the few that really appreciated what he did for the Bulls, but I think his departure is going to leave a big hole.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think it's important. I think a lot of fans will look at Tony, a guy like Tony Snell, and he can be really frustrating on offense, but it's easy to forget that there's two sides to the basketball and that you're actually on defense 50% of the time in a basketball game. So I think guys who are really good defenders are undervalued, and that's actually probably because we don't have many great ways of quantifying how good individuals are on defense. Outside of blocks and steals, we don't have a lot of measures to gauge how good a guy is defensively. So that's much more of an art than science to evaluate guys on the defensive end individually at this point. So that's one thing I'm really looking forward to in analytics is people starting to solve that mystery and maybe look at ways through the sport view data, that's the 3D data from the cameras that are in every NBA arena. And I think there's a lot of exciting possibilities to start figuring out a little bit better how guys are as individual defenders and how that contributes to their value on the court.
Great stuff. I think a lot of that has to do, I don't know if you agree with me here, Grant, but you know, the best players in the NBA offensively, you can't guard them one-on-one. I don't care how good a defender you are. The best defender in the league is going to have issues with guarding LeBron James, and it really is a team concept when it comes to defense, and that's why I think it's really hard to kind of evaluate a guy one-on-one. I've never really seen any analytics really that really support whether or not a guy is really good as an individual defender. Gasol got so much hate and so much heat for being a poor defender, but you look at Nylon Calculus, and he was ranked as one of the best rim defenders in the NBA. You know, he did have good rebounding numbers. It's such a difficult thing to really measure or quantify. Do you agree or disagree?
Absolutely agree. It's so impossible, especially because, as you say, a lot of teams, it's scheme-based, and they're really defending as a team, especially when you think of the old Tibbs defenses that especially was important there. And how does a guy not only fit into the system as an individual defender, but how does he embrace his role defensively, especially for big men, I think is really important and really hard to quantify. So that's where these advanced scouts and all these sorts of guys, more and more teams are hiring more and more scouts to scout the NBA, whether that's to prepare for a game against an upcoming opponent or to prepare to see who might be a great fit in free agency or via trade. So I think that's a really wise investment for teams. I know the Pistons have the most, they've made huge hires under their new regime in hiring more advanced scouts in that way. And I think that's a really valuable resource that more teams should look into increasing.
I just want to first of all say thank you so much for jumping on and talking basketball with us. This has been extremely valuable and I think very interesting for the listeners. Hopefully you'll have time to join us again. I'm really hoping we can get you on again because I know there's going to be a lot of questions and emails as follow-up to this. Last question. I don't know if you had any insight or any idea on who's going to win the title for the NBA. I think our listeners would love to hear your opinion.
You know, I still, even though as this is, we're recording this podcast, it looks like Steph Curry's going to be out for a minimum of 2 weeks. But despite that, I do think I still like the Warriors to win this season. I think that what Draymond and Klay and all those guys can do, they can handle what the Clippers have. I think they can beat them. And I do believe from what I've read that Steph would be available for the Western Conference Finals. So I think that at this point they're just too good on both ends of the court, really good defensive team to the way that they guard, especially pick and rolls is super impressive. So I do believe that the Warriors will be able to win. And if I had to pick one upset coming, I wouldn't be shocked to see the Heat beat the Cavs if it comes to that. Because people have been a little bit up and down on the Cavs, and I just don't know that they have what it takes and if they have the ability to really get baskets when they need to. So that would be my upset special. But I do believe that the Warriors are going to come out with the championship this year.
Great. Thanks so much, Tim. Thanks a lot for joining, too. And I look forward to having you on, hopefully again, Grant. And thanks again for joining the Bullseye.
GrantGoodstein at Grant Goodstein. So, yeah,
fantastic.
Be happy for anyone who's interested to follow me. So,
thanks a lot, Grant. Thanks a million.
Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to, if you want me back, I'm happy to be back.
Absolutely. We'll definitely take you up on that. Thank you so much. And, Tim, thanks for the introduction. Have a good one, guys.
No problem. All right. See you guys.
Bye-bye.